Well, that sounds like an okay place to do a fade. Probably not how the artist intended it, but, well, it's live radio again. Well, actually, I've got mostly recordings, as usual, stuff I've gleaned from a variety of spaces, marginalized views. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Mumia's got a commentary up, so it's been a bit. It's a memorial for a colleague journalist. Mumia Abu-Jamal was a stringer for WHYY in Philly, as well as a writer for a weekly. Before, I think he got entrapped. He's got a new trial to prove that, so he's probably working on that a bit. This hasn't been very... Prison radio is going on. COVID at Rush City, Minnesota is one of the topics. What have I got? Well, Amy Goodman's got a respite from Ukraine coverage. She did a fair good lot of it this week. Had the guy from the Quincy Institute, whose name I've been trying to commit to memory because he's one of the few people I like. I'm emotionally drained. This has been taxing in a lot of ways. I follow this closely. I share Ray McGovern's point of view. I didn't expect it to be full scale. I expected it something like what the Russians would have called liberating the Donbass. I did not expect a full onslaught. That's hard to say that it's a full onslaught, but it's awful. It's just awful. The Nation has an editorial that gets my opinion on this fairly, and it's cited by colleague and KPFA's Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein. Got two segments with him. One has a little respite from Ukraine coverage with Harvey Wasserman, who grew up in Ohio. I believe he's out in the West Coast now fighting Diablo Cannon. He's an anti-nuclear activist. Solartopia at gmail.com. I believe he's got a website of the same name, Solartopia. But he did a lot of work in election fairness in Ohio some decades ago. Quite a few years he worked on that. He's doing it out in California too, but mainly anti-nuclear activism. And he's highlighting the nuclear situation in the sense of the power plants in Ukraine. All right. I sort of storyboarded everything in a way, I guess. Maybe not. Francis Boyle, controversial fellow. He is in this law school at the U of I, which has a big Federalist Society component there. I remember there used to be a larger-than-life picture of Ronald Reagan standing tall in the basement of the law school. I forget how I stumbled on that. Don't usually frequent that, but must be difficult and draining to deal with that every day. And I wouldn't consult him on viruses and vaccines and stuff, but international law is his specialty. He doesn't hold anything back in this, so opinions are his. I do want to share it because, well, I think it's important to get a diverse set of opinions down. And Scott Ritter, I'll be truncating him. He's on this Radio Sputnik show again. I wish he was on media. Flashpoints hasn't had McGovern on in a while, and they're in a pledge drive right now. So I think maybe things are a little under duress. In fact, Harvey Wasserman is on twice, it seems, and that's because he's a great pitcher. Francis Boyle does a pitch at the end of his interlude, too, because he knows community radio needs support. All right, I ran it all down, and the order will be Francis Boyle first, Harvey Wasserman, and then Scott Ritter. Remember him? He was the inspector who tried to stop the invasion of Iraq by Bush, too. In his capacity as a UN inspector, he was in Russia seeing overseeing the dismantling of weapons in that day when people were dismantling nuclear weapons as opposed to improving them with $9 trillion over 10 years, which is what the U.S. intends to do, unless somebody stops the madness. Okay, I thought Amy would have a piece on this international conference that's happening straight away, and that is convened by Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, and therefore includes Jeremy Corbyn, who is still a member of Parliament. Remember, he was Prime Minister for a while. Got attacked right and left. Code Pink's probably the initiator. Stop the War Coalition and No to NATO Network. So it's possible to be against the invasion of Ukraine by Russia and be against NATO. That's my stance anyway. A member of the French National Assembly, member of the German Bundestag, the Vijay Prashad, now an independent activist, journalist, writer, Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, Lindsay German of the aforementioned UK Stop the War Coalition, a woman from an anti-NATO peace summit in Madrid, Nina Potarska, Ukraine section of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. WIFL is still around. A Belgian speaker who was on Democracy Now! A couple of weeks ago, Ludo de Brander, that's not it. My Flemish is not up to snuff. Or maybe that's French. And a Russian journalist with the U.S.-Russia Women's Call for Peace. And I won't try to say her name. You can go to Code Pink and find the sign-on. It's on a YouTube as well as a Zoom. I've got both of them ready to queue up at 11 o'clock. So that's playing opposite the very good show here, Radio Free Labor. Hope it's a full compliment. We haven't heard from Stephanie in a while. And there are some labor issues as well as international issues. Paul Farmer is memorialized here. He died in a hospital he created, helped create in Rwanda. There's a big backstory on Rwanda that never gets in the U.S. press, and I thank Gus Wood of the Radio Free Labor for doing a deep dive on that a while back. He's doing a Black History of Labor series, and it's well commended. Both of these will be archived, so if you have something else to do, you can catch up later, which is maybe what I'll do because I'm feeling pretty strained here. All right, already 7 minutes in, and I do feel like I should play Mumia's commentary because he hasn't done one in a while, even though it sets me back. We even get less of Scott Ritter at the very end of the segment where he shares the panel with Ray McGovern, ex-CIA analyst, who frequent listeners are... Well, I play him so much frequently that even occasional listeners may have heard me speak of him before.
Askia Muhammad, black journalist. He was known as Askia Muhammad, and in his 76 years of life, he was principally known and indeed renowned as a black journalist. But he was also a poet, a photographer, and hosted a radio program in Washington, D.C.'s Pacifica station, WPFW. He was a senior editor and correspondent for The Final Call, the weekly journal of the Nation of Islam. He wrote for The Washington Informer, a black-owned newspaper serving the black community in D.C. Askia Muhammad worked as a journalist and broadcaster at WPFW for more than 40 years. He called his show Yardbird Suites, a tribute of sorts to the jazz saxophonist Charlie Parker, whose nickname was Yardbird. In an interview with The Final Call, Muhammad explained how his jazz show began. I discovered in my limited collection that there was a recording by Charlie Parker. My name, given by my mother, was Charles, so I had some identification with that. Then I discovered that he recorded a song, his signature song, Yardbird Suite. The Yardbird Suite was recorded on my first birthday. So I said, it's a natural. I'll have a Yardbird show. And that was it. Muhammad's show was called a vital addition to DC's culture. Askia Muhammad returned to the source on Thursday, February 17th, after 76 winters in America. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Indeed. We haven't heard one in a while. The latest edition, The Public Eye, is out, and it has articles by James Kilgore and Helen Neville and Nicholas Grant, both on countering violence, gun violence in Champaign County. Brian Dolinar taking the Band-Aid off mass incarceration, with some stuff from some women's prisons, among other things. Traffic equity. A piece which I need to reread, The Unacknowledged and Ongoing Genocide, Violence Against African Americans. Genocide is a broader definition than the most famous one. It doesn't necessarily involve putting people in camps. It can be a cultural genocide, too. Just noting that. You can get involved with The Public Eye. Pick one up, go online, search for it. There's a link through the IMC website. Well, it's really marching on here. I hope you're sitting comfortably. I mentioned I was playing the interview with Francis Boyle next, and let's try and do that. Again, this was recorded midweek.
First of all, this from The Nation. War is a tragedy, a crime, and a defeat. The Nation condemns the decision of Russian President Vladimir Putin to abandon the path of diplomacy by attacking and undertaking a special military operation or operations in Ukraine. These actions violate international law and fuel a dangerous escalation of violence. We urge all parties to immediately cease hostilities, to de-escalate, and seek a diplomatic solution to mitigate the risk of full-scale war and an unthinkable direct conflict between the world's two largest nuclear powers. Now, our guest, who's coming up to join us in just a minute, Francis Boyle, writes and wrote today, or said today, obviously a case can be made that Russia's actions violate international law. But we need to look at the actual circumstances of the case. And joining us to do just that is Professor Francis Boyle, who is Professor of International Law at the University of Illinois. Professor Boyle, it's been a while. It's good to have you back with us. So, I mean, it is a fact. Nobody can deny that the United States bombed Iraq illegally in the first Bush, and then they bombed Iraq illegally under the second Bush, and Joe Biden made sure that illegal war happened based on false weaponry. Included in that operation against Iraq, we carried out an extreme attack on their infrastructure, leading to the death of tens of thousands, perhaps over 100,000 children. But you might say two wrongs don't make a right, or two rights don't make a wrong. Francis Boyle, what's your perspective on the invasion? Clearly, he's invaded civilian areas, and great risks have been taken against human life.
Well, Dennis, thank you very much for having me on, my best to your listening audience. We really have to go back here to the agreements made by Jim Baker and Secretary General Gorbachev and the other European leaders at that time, that if Gorbachev agreed to the reunification of Germany, NATO would not extend one inch farther to the east. Now, that was not put into writing, but under basic principles of international law that I teach to my students, oral commitments made by high-level government officials, such as secretary of states, prime ministers, et cetera, are binding under international law. So the Soviets had a binding commitment from the United States and several of these other European states that NATO would not move to the east. What happened then was Clinton came into power, and under the influence of Strobe Talbot, his so-called Soviet expert, proceeded to expand NATO to the east, right up to the borders of Russia, where they are today. And Ukraine is part of that project. Second, then, came the 2014 coup d'etat that was paid for and sponsored and organized by the United States against a democratically elected government in Ukraine under Yanukovych, and put into power a gang of neo-Nazi thugs that are still there today, and proceeded to engage in ethnic cleansing and pogroms against Russian speakers in Ukraine. As for this statement by the nation, you know, that they should return to negotiations, in 2014 and 2015, Russia went along with the Minsk Accords. And yet what happened was the United States did absolutely nothing to encourage the Ukrainian government to negotiate in accordance with the Minsk Accords in good faith. The Minsk Accords could have resolved this problem, but we did not want it resolved. We still wanted to maintain our neo-Nazi military platform there in Russia to be in Ukraine to be used against Russia. So basically what happened was that Putin issued his ultimatum in December, starting what could only be called a Cuban Missile Crisis in reverse, taking the same position on the U.S.-NATO military Nazi regime in Ukraine that JFK took towards the Soviet missiles in Cuba. And they tried to negotiate in good faith with the Bidenites for 2 months and got absolutely nowhere. Their demands were quite simple. Their main demands, one, NATO must not expand anymore, and two, Ukraine must not join NATO. The Bidenites refused to give them any of those commitments, even though the United States government was bound to give them those commitments as far back as Jim Baker and Gorbachev. So I should point out that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that was 13 days. Here it was 2 months. Putin gave us 2 months. And President Kennedy was fully prepared to invade Cuba if he had not been able to negotiate through back channels the agreement with Khrushchev to remove the Soviet missiles from Cuba, which he was able to do, and there was no invasion. By contrast here, Bidenites refused to negotiate on the critical points. So Putin treated this like Kennedy would have treated Cuba with the Soviet missiles still there and invaded. It's a terrible situation. But you have to understand that the front lines there at Donetsk, the front lines to this neo-Nazi regime forces at Donetsk are 460 kilometers from Stalingrad, Volgograd. Now, Dennis, I've toured the front lines, World War II front lines at Leningrad, where the Germans starved a million Leningraders to death, including killing Putin's brother. The front lines at Moscow that basically ended right where near the trolley lines into the city where they ended. And I have been to Stalingrad, now called Volgograd, and the sheer genocidal savagery of the Germans took my breath away. Now, that's who was 460 kilometers away from Stalingrad. So under these circumstances, I think Putin saw this as an existential threat to Russia and the Russians, and he has acted the way he has. It's regrettable that it's come to this, but there were numerous ways to prevent it by the United States government, and indeed, we provoked it.
You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Professor of International Law at the University of Illinois, Francis Boyle, author of many good books, an expert on international law and on many things legal. And we're always happy to have him on the air. Now, as you point out, Putin is no Gandhi, but it's doubtful that any Russian leader would tolerate the sort of the way in which NATO is moving in on Russia.
That's correct, Dennis. As a matter of fact, I offered both Soviet politics and Russian history for my PhD oral exams at Harvard and passed. And that qualified me to teach both Soviet politics and Russian history to Harvard undergraduates. So I've studied, you know, their entire history here.
Yes.
From the get-go, and indeed going back to Ukraine. When I was invited to lecture there and met a lot of their peace leaders and lawyers and government officials, and even asked for a tour of the monastery where Nestor wrote his chronicles. And even both the Russian and the Ukrainian there said, yes, this is the start of Kievan civilization, Russian civilization. So I'm acutely aware of the history of both people here. But I don't see how Putin could have done anything differently, because NATO would have continued to expand. We were already pumping in billions of dollars of weapons, equipment, supplies, trainers to this neo-Nazi regime that we installed. And let me say, you know, Dennis, we both know that the United States government has covertly cooperated with Nazis going back to Operation Paperclip. But, and you're free to correct me if I'm wrong, but this was the first time, certainly in my lifetime, that we overtly and proudly cooperated with, armed, equipped, supplied, and trained an overtly neo-Nazi regime. And, of course, you have no idea that the Soviet Union suffered 27 million people dead, and they're just 460 kilometers from Stalingrad, and I've been there. It just took my breath away to see what happened there.
Can I just throw this thing in here? People say, and I've heard this, how can you say neo-Nazi? It's led by a Jew. You know, is this Jew supporting a neo-Nazi regime?
Well, he's a figurehead. But if you don't take my word for it, you cited the Nation. Today, there is an article on The Nation documenting in detail, just hit their webpage, on the Nazi, neo-Nazi control and domination in Ukraine. Right. It's all there in The Nation today.
Say a little bit more about, I mean, the dual standard. You know, people say, oh, you know, you can't, comparison kills and all that stuff. But the dual standard, just for instance, let's take the U.S. relationship with the Saudis. You know, they've demonstrated they're willing to kill a U.S. journalist and shred him in an embassy. Yet, you've got the United States government fueling in the air Saudi planes that are committing slaughters in Yemen and creating a famine.
It's outright
genocide. Hard for the United States to talk morality, isn't it?
It's outright genocide what the Saudis are doing to the Houthis in Yemen. And yes, we are arming, equipping, supplying, and assisting the Saudis and basically aiding and abetting their genocide against the Houthis in Yemen in violation of the 1948 Genocide Convention. But let me return to Ukraine and what could be done now. I mean, this is a very dangerous situation. If, you know, President Biden, I listened to his press conference today, basically announcing economic warfare against Russia. If he really wanted to solve this problem and de-escalate, first he could announce that NATO will not be expanding. Period. That's the end of it. You know, we are NATO. NATO does what we tell them to do. NATO will not be expanded. Second, he can definitely announce that Ukraine will not be joining NATO. And third, that they will go back in good faith to try to negotiate under the Minsk Accords. But Biden said nothing like that today. He just escalated it. And if you're reading the news media, following the wire services today, sending more and more military equipment surrounding Russia on all sides under the pretext, well, he has to bolster the NATO states when Russia has not threatened any of these NATO states. Their problem is Ukraine, because as they see it, Ukraine is an American NATO dagger pointed right at the heart of Mother Russia. And so they had to do something about it. But it still can be de-escalated now if Biden wanted to do it. But I don't believe that is the agenda here on the Biden administration. And also, I would say to some extent, Biden and the Bidenites are wagging the dog here. Because, as you know, they have not controlled this pandemic. The economy is in the toilet. And rather than dealing with the very serious problems we have here at home, he's just wagging the dog all over again and saying he wants to promote democracy in Ukraine. Well, how many times have we heard U.S. military invasions of countries saying, well, we're out there to promote democracy? I mean, Woodrow Wilson said that on the First World War. And yet, as we know, his Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, quit and said it's all a lie. Wilson's been scheming to get us into the First World War from the get-go. So, you know, this could get out of hand over there if it's not brought under control immediately. This could be a tinderbox for even Zelensky pointed out, it could become a pan-European war, and it could be, yes.
And we're about to get into this big time, but what happened today in terms of the Russians taking back Chernobyl, please, nobody light a match. That is such a risky moment in history. You got the bulletin of the atomic scientists. They don't even have any more room. We're past midnight. And what's going on there in Ukraine, obviously, is extremely dangerous for so many different reasons. But nukes are...
I think they have 10 more nuclear reactors in Ukraine. I think the Russians were concerned that the Ukrainians, Zelensky twice now threatened to get nuclear weapons. I think they were concerned that they might manufacture some type of dirty bomb there at Chernobyl. So they secured Chernobyl, and you're right, it was very dangerous. It could get worse.
Well, it's its own dirty bomb waiting to happen. We all know that about nuclear power plants. So we're going to have to leave it right there. Francis Boyle, always appreciate having you on the show. You are a professor of international law at the University of Illinois, written wonderful books about the law, beautifully written. You've even written poetry about resistance. We appreciate you, Professor Boyle. We hope you'll come back soon.
Well, thanks, Dennis. And since the KPFA fund drive is on, I do hope everyone will pitch in something they can all continue to hear progressive voices on this station. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short musical break. When we come back, we're going to just go straight ahead.
Yeah, they have a great rapport. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And I'm not wrapped too tight today. I guess I give a little testimonial to Paul Farmer in my own words and didn't play the Amy Goodman piece, which is... Anyway, I guess I shouldn't have pointed that out for the people that just tuned in. Again, that was Francis Boyle down the block at the university. Pretty beleaguered, I think, in his academic situation with all of the right-wing Federalist Society lawyers around him. Okay. I think we should go on as was foreshadowed by Dennis Bernstein there and get to the piece about Chernobyl. and nuclear power, longtime anti-nuclear activist. And note that the NEC is, well, I guess I better not digress, because I could go on for a while about that. Instead, we'll let Harvey Wasserman have his own say. I think I'm going to elide this a little bit, too, when he starts talking about the election theft work he's been doing for decades. There's going to be a, or at least Dennis says that he's going to do a special, which probably include Wasserman and Greg Palast. And that would be a great thing, and I'll try and bring that to the air. In its entirety, maybe.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Well, our next guest writes, as home to Chernobyl, the world's deadliest atomic reactor disaster, Ukraine depends for more than half of its electricity on 15 nuclear reactors. All but two were built by the Soviet Union. Until now, they've been mostly serviced and fueled by Russia. Because it is so heavily laden with poorly stored, highly radioactive material, any military assault would be fraught with horrific potential fallout. And that is only the beginning, Harvey Wasserman writes. This is an important piece he did for The Progressive. Harvey, this is something we need to talk about. Will you please outline this for us? What's the thumbnail sketch?
Okay. Thank you, Dennis. I also have a piece about this at Reader Supported News. This is an incredibly serious situation. Ukraine has 15 atomic reactors. There are four more are there at Chernobyl. They're all dead. And, of course, the Chernobyl accident killed more than a million people. And any one of these 15 reactors could be attacked in a heartbeat by Putin if he wanted to. It would take nothing to turn any one of these 15 reactors into a total apocalyptic engine of radiation release. You don't need Putin to do it. You could have a crew of madmen, or even just one, that could set off one of these reactors. There are six of them at a place near where Putin is and the Ukrainians are disputing the territory. And those six reactors comprise the biggest atomic power station in the world. These reactors, the 12 of the 15 reactors, are 30 years old or more. And they are all constructed by the former Soviet Union. And the great irony is that here you have this dispute between these two countries, and Russia has been responsible for maintaining and fueling 12 of these reactors. How do you go to war with a country that is controlling your atomic power plant and half the nation's electricity supply? None of the major media is talking. They won't touch this because the nuclear industry does not want to hear that the so-called peaceful atomic reactors are about to be turned into engines of mass destruction. But these reactors are incredibly vulnerable. And it would not even take a military action to turn them into an apocalyptic explosion, because they're old, they're badly maintained, they are incredibly vulnerable to fire, to loss of water, to a blackout of the grid. This is the fruit that we've been talking about so many years, Dennis, of the peaceful atom. These reactors are indefensible. There's nothing you can do to stop a tiny crew if they really want to turn one of these reactors into another Chernobyl. That's what.
Now, will you remind people, Harv, say a little bit more about Chernobyl for our new listeners, our younger listeners? This isn't the first problem that we're facing based on Chernobyl, but it could be the worst.
Absolutely. I mean, you got six. Well, at Chernobyl, there were four reactors. Thank God the other three didn't explode. But on April 26, 1986, Unit 4 exploded. It sent radiation all over the world. A major 2007 study showed that by then, 980,000 people had been killed by radiation spread around the world from Chernobyl. And it will be far worse today because there'd be far more radiation at these old reactors. Chernobyl was relatively new when it blew up. But when you have reactors that have operated for 30 years, they accumulate gargantuan reserves of radioactive waste that cannot be dealt with. And God forbid there's an explosion at any one of these 15 reactors in Ukraine. The radiation will be here within 10 days. And as it came to California in 1986, there was a study of bird births done at the Point Reyes Bird Sanctuary north of San Francisco. And it was very clear that the radiation had come down from Chernobyl in the spring rain and had killed 60% of the birds in the sanctuary. This is in California, X thousand miles away from Chernobyl. So, as I say, there are six reactors very close to disputed territory. The country could go dark. And if the country goes dark, if they lose their electric grid, they're going to lose the nuclear plant because all the reactors have to have backup power. And anybody wants to hit the backup power at any of these reactor stations and then black out the grid, which would take Putin about 5 minutes to do, and not even, you know, a millionth of his military strength would be needed to do that, you know, it's over. That country will be blanketed with radiation. Europe will be blanketed with radiation, and there's nothing they can do about it. You know, all this talk about geopolitical this and troops moving here, you have pre-deployed radioactive atomic weapons of mass destruction sitting there, right there, operating every day, 15 of them. And you know, I can't even, obviously, I can't begin to overstate the seriousness of this situation. And none of the major media are talking about it because we have 93 reactors in the United States. They're also vulnerable, 400 worldwide. This is why you don't build atomic power plants, for God's sake. We've been talking about this for 40 years, and nobody's paid attention. And they're still not paying attention, even though they're on the brink of war with 15 pre-deployed atomic apocalypses sitting right there.
So, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Let me just say, that's the voice of Harvey Wasserman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're talking about nukes, Russian nukes in the Ukraine, that the fact that Russia is responsible for the upkeep of these deteriorating nuclear reactors, which are so incredibly dangerous, Harvey, it is amazing. I'm watching the corporate press, the sort of stenographers. They're all salivating. They all, you know how they have their lookalike outfits that, you know, they put them on with the helmets and the flak jackets, and you can't tell them apart from the military, and you probably shouldn't be able to tell them apart because what they are is stenographers for war. And that's why this story, this corporate story, you know, if one reporter on one network really tried to report this story, you'd see a big absence, a big missing spot where that reporter was, because these stories don't come out. Go on, I'm sorry.
No, there'd be a hook or a trap door. This is a situation where they can't handle the truth. The normal dialogue about war and peace does not apply here. You when you get a country into a state of chaos, like Ukraine is on the brink, and you know, you're not talking about conventional warfare here. You're talking about a totally unpredictable situation that could, by complete accident, result in an apocalyptic release of radiation, but absolutely devastate Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, most of Europe, and it would come here, as it did in 1986. This is not a novel situation here. You know, every one of those reactors in Ukraine has to be immediately shut and somehow safeguarded, because it doesn't take anything to cut off a cooling system or backup power or use cyber warfare to screw up their control rooms. These control rooms are 30 years old. These reactors were designed before the digital age. I mean, you know, they're Volkswagens from a previous century, these reactors. and incredibly dangerous situation here that the mainstream media and probably many thinkers in our government can't even imagine. You know?
Harvey Wasserman. I think they go on and talk about election theft and then reprise some more about nukes in Ukraine, the plants, not weapons. From flashpoints.net, I believe he came back another day and talked about it again. So you can find that. Again, there's this online thing. It's on the YouTube channel that Code Pink runs. It starts at 11 o'clock. Radio Free Labor coming up, too. And just enough time to maybe get some Ray McGovern and Scott Ritter on. Best way to find this, I guess, is through RayMcGovern.com, his personal website. That is Sun Runs From, I think. And number nine. Let's see. Why don't I do it this way? Opinions are those of the speakers. And we'll get the first segment of this on when I planned. Again, you can find it through RayMcGovern.com, antiwar.com also hosts this program called The Critical Hour with Wilmer and Garland as hosts. But Scott Ritter and Ray McGovern are the guys. Again, Scott Ritter, well, I guess he's well introduced here in this segment.
We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
Al Jazeera reports Moscow floats prospect of talks. Putin open to sending delegation to Minsk, Kremlin says, as Russian troops target Ukraine's capital. What are we to make of all of this? Well, it's Friday. That means it's panel time. Let's turn to the panel. We're joined by a gentleman who leads the Speaking Truth to Power section of Tell the World, which is a publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior of in inner city Washington. He served as a CIA analyst for 27 years. His duties included chairing the National Intelligence Estimates, preparing the President's Daily Brief. He also co-created Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. He is Ray McGovern. As always, Ray, welcome back.
Thank you.
We're also joined by a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer and author of Scorpion King, America's Suicidal Embrace of Nuclear Weapons from FDR to Trump. He served in the Soviet Union as an inspector implementing the INF Treaty, served in General Schwarzkopf's staff during the Gulf War, and from 91 to 98 served as a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq. Scott Ritter, as always, Scott, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So let me just, a very simple question starting with you, Ray. What are we now? I guess day two here. Where are we in this conflict?
Well, we're on day two, I would say. it's kind of hard to know at this distance, isn't it?
Yes.
We hear reports with respect to Soviet Russian troops circling Kyiv. That's interesting. What about Zelensky? Where is he? Well, at last report, he was there. He was going to stand his ground. And then there are reports that other countries are thinking, well, maybe we could get this thing done through negotiations. So I don't know exactly where the situation on the ground lies, but I have learned something very important over these past couple of days. As you know, I never expected Putin to be invading Ukraine. I thought it would be a crazy thing to do. I underestimated the feeling of outrage that he and many of his peers in Russia feel with respect to what the West has done to Ukraine, starting mostly with the coup that the West arranged, on the 22nd of February, 2014. Now, what has happened to Russian citizens? What has happened to Russian speakers in Ukraine? It's really indefensible. I didn't get a real accurate feel for that until I listened and watched the speech that Putin gave when he announced the invasion. The other thing is that I thought that he would be hindered. That he would be hindered not only by the expected Western opprobrium, But also, I would think that since his great ally is China now, my thinking was that he would seek, maybe permission, but he would tell the Chinese, oh, this is what I do. And he may have indeed told Xi Jinping that when he was in Beijing at the start of the Olympics on the 4th of February. Whatever. I was convinced, and I checked this out with Chinese specialists, that were Putin to say, well, how about we Russians invade Ukraine? Xi would say, no way, niet, whatever the Chinese word for no is. Now, everyone agreed with me on that. I mean, everyone agreed that that would be the Chinese reaction because of their long principled stand on non-aggression and non-violation of international borders. Turns out we were wrong. And it turns out that the Chinese reaction has been quite remarkable. It's a support for what Putin has done. It's an acknowledgement that he has legitimate grievances, and it's an endorsement of his main shtick, which is to prevent the further encroachment of NATO eastward, threatening Russia. This is big. Not only China, but India is not come aboard here with sanctions and other things. And so, whereas Biden can claim the whole world is on his side except Russia, well, actually, in reality, if you take population alone, most of the world is with Russia, if you count China. And with India, well, they may change. They hate China as much as anybody else. But for the nonce, they have been unwilling to go ahead with the sanctions and with the approval of what the West is trying to do to condemn Putin.
Scott, same question to you, but with this added point. Zelensky says Ukraine left alone to fight Russia, NATO is afraid. He delivered a speech after the first day of the assault and said they've been left alone. NATO is afraid to help. We are left alone in defense of our state. Who is ready to fight with us? Honestly, I do not see such. Who is ready to guarantee Ukraine's accession to NATO? Honestly, everyone is afraid. Scott Ritter.
Well, I mean, with all due respect to Zelensky, you have to have the intellectual capacity of a worm to not have realized you could have written that same script a month ago, 2 months ago, 3 months ago, 4 months ago. NATO was never going to fight for Ukraine. Ukraine was never going to become a NATO member, ever. And if Ukraine does, and I'll say this to any of the Georgian listeners that might be out there, not from the great state of Georgia, but from the Republic of Georgia. If you think for a second that NATO membership somehow guarantees you a secure and prosperous future, think again. Watch as Ukraine has swallowed the suicide pill, and it's not a quick bolt of cyanide. This is the agony kind of suicide that's going to, you know, take place over the course of, you know, days. And that's what's happening right now. I mean, we're 2 days into it. Everybody's panicking, according to the TV. The Pentagon panicking, NATO's panicking. Hell, they just mobilized their rapid reaction force. Biden's panicking. Everybody's screaming, you know, they unleash sanctions that they say are going to take weeks, if not months, to unfold. And then they panic the next day. Oh, my God, we got to do different sanctions. Everybody's panicking, except who? The Russians. There's zero panic there. None whatsoever. You know how many press briefings there's been by the Russian Ministry of Defense to explain what they're doing in Ukraine to the world? Zero. They don't care. They're going on their plan, their timeline, and they're just going to grind this thing out until it's done. The notion that this is going to end by some sort of negotiated settlement is absurd. Putin called Zelensky's bluff. Zelensky's crying, hey, I want to do diplomacy now. Putin went, all right, we'll meet you. No, we can't do it in Minsk. That's your territory. We're going to do it in Warsaw, my territory. Okay, we'll meet you in Warsaw. Oh, no, now we can't do it. No. Zelensky was playing it yet again, another European-American propaganda card to float the prospects of diplomacy, believing that Russia would never take it up, and then we could continue the narrative that Russia has rejected a diplomatic settlement. Russia has never rejected a diplomatic settlement. Russia has always said there is a diplomatic solution here. But the West has never taken it up, and the West has actually pressured Zelensky to avoid this. I don't think too many people know this, but last June, there was a meeting of the Normandy format, and I think they met again later this fall. And the Normandy format is the group of Germany, the United Kingdom, France, and Ukraine that meet together in consultation with Russia to resolve the Donetsk and Lugansk issue and to implement the Minsk Accords. And, you know, if you listen to the French, the Germans, the British, and the Ukrainians, everything was good. We're on track with Minsk. And the Russians were like, guy, you were in a different meeting. So the Russians released the transcripts where the Russians said, we need you to, you know, implement Minsk now. That's what needs to happen. And you had everybody around the table say, no, no, no. So the Russians went, well, if you're going to say no, we're going to tell the world. This is why Minsk isn't happening, because you're rejecting diplomacy. And that's just the reality. Ukraine has been used. Ukraine has been used by NATO, by the United States, as a foil against Russia. And now Ukraine is paying the ultimate price. I have nothing but sympathy for the Ukrainian civilians who aren't members of neo-Nazi groups. I have nothing but sympathy for the Ukrainian military who aren't affiliated with neo-Nazi groups. But I have no sympathy for the Ukrainian government, and I have no sympathy for the neo-Nazis. You, Ray, you mentioned the anger that the Russians have. You know, you'll hear people talk about this, about Odessa, about the 30, and the number may be 50. But, you know, do people realize that a few weeks after the Maidan revolt, Russian speakers in Odessa gathered together in a demonstration of what they believed was the abuse they were receiving at the hands of these neo-Nazi Ukrainian nationalists, and they were ushered into a hall and burned alive, live on TV, burned alive. And the Russians are outraged. Nobody in the world would. I mean, man, if Hezbollah put 50 Jews into a building and burned them alive, we'd still be making movies about it today in outrage. They burned 30 to 50 Russian speakers alive for daring to say, hey, we don't like what you're doing. And the world was silent. You want to know why Russia is enraged? That's one reason. The other reason is for the last 8 years, women and children have been killed on a daily basis from bombardment out of the Ukrainian-held territory and with nothing but silence from the Western world, as if Russian lives don't matter. And then finally, the ultimate thing, and again, my wife is from the former Soviet Union. She's Georgian from Sukhumi, so there is no love lost between her and the Russians. But my God, you need to understand the antipathy that exists in the Russian soul about Nazi Germany, about the SOBs that invaded their country on June 22nd, 1941, and killed over 23 million of their people in a brutal war, a brutal war. And the Russians, the Soviets were able to push them out, take over the den of the devil in Berlin, and terminate Adolf Hitler and the Nazi ideology. And now it's reemerging in Ukraine on their border in a manner that is destroying Russian lives. Yeah, Russia went to war. They had every reason to go to war. I support their war. Not because I support Putin, not because I support Russian grand objectives, because I'm a human being that understands that Nazi Germany cannot be allowed to resurrect its ugly head in anywhere in Europe, especially in a country that aspires to NATO membership.
Ray, one of the things that I know you covered was Putin's speech. And when I think back, I always, if something happens, I look back at the red flags and indicators. And one of them was Vladimir Putin, Sergei Lavrov, they kept saying, you've backed us into a corner. We have nowhere to retreat. And I think of, you know, Sun Tzu saying, always leave your enemy an avenue to retreat. I think of everything, you know, martial arts, they teach you, don't back somebody into a corner. They'll kill you even if they don't know how to fight. They'll bite and scratch you to death if they can. And it seems to me that was a red flag that they felt backed into a corner. Your thoughts on that and Vladimir Putin's speech, Ray McGovern?
Yeah, well, I'd like to combine that with a comment on what Scott just said.
Certainly, certainly.
He's really right on in emphasizing the indignity, the outrage of Odessa, the massacre there on May 2, 2014, after we had mounted the coup enabling those kinds of massacres on February 22, 2014. And we have that on audio tape if anybody wants to challenge the notion that we orchestrated that coup. So here we are on the 2nd of May, 2014. What happened 2 weeks later? Lugansk and Donetsk declared independence. They were primarily Russian-speaking, Russian-stock people. They didn't want any part of what happened to their compatriots in Odessa, okay? So 2 weeks, that I think is revelatory, that they did that then and that they went to Russia and they said, look, Mr. Putin, we'd like to have you annex us like you just did Crimea. And he said, no, no way. We'll give you a lot of help. We'll give you some volunteers. We'll give you some training and weapons. You can defend yourselves, but no way. You know, Crimea was a special thing. We're not going to annex you. So that's the background for all that. So we're talking 2 weeks after May 2nd. What happened next? We tried to get the Europeans to institute serious, biting, comprehensive sanctions. The Europeans in those days resisted. Okay, so we did a bunch of sanctions until someone shot down KAL, sorry, not KAL, but MH17, the Malaysian aircraft that was downed over Ukraine with almost 300 people killed. And John Kerry got up and he said, we have evidence, we have trajectory evidence, we know when the missile was fired and where it came down. So, and they all blamed it on the Russians. Now, where is that evidence? No evidence has ever been adduced. The evidence is contradictory. And even the people up in The Hague, where a trial is going on, say they have been deprived of this evidence that John Kerry cited. And that evidence, in my view, does not exist. What? Why do I mention that? Well, because then the West Europeans got harnessed behind sanctions. And that's where we are today. The West Europeans are acting like a bunch of vassal states so far. Now, if it comes to canceling, not just delaying the certification of, but canceling the gas, the Nord Stream 2 project, then we're going to see the Germans making very, very difficult decisions. I'm not sure what they'll decide now, but it's not an automatic yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir to the U.S. diktat. I forget, Garland, what path you were following there in your question, but I'll address that very briefly.
Putin's speech, the speech.
Oh, yeah.
And being saying that he was being backed
into a corner that they had nowhere to retreat from.
Yeah, well, you know, he sounded to me like he had experienced what I experienced as a child in the Bronx, okay? I wasn't a weakling, but I kept getting beat up by bigger guys. And I remember myself saying, I can still feel it in my bones, when I get big, I'm not going to let anybody push me around, okay? Now, Putin wasn't big enough, okay? He wasn't big enough. What changed? What made him big enough 10 months or so ago? Well, he cultivated this long-term relationship with somebody very, very big, Xi Jinping, president of China. And he started feeling really big. And lo and behold, in December, he made some demands. And the U.S. and NATO did not take them seriously enough, in his view. Meanwhile, the head of Ukraine had publicly made it country's policy to take back Crimea, to take back the Donbass. And that was 11 months ago. So Putin had all this time to think it over and say, how can I make myself big enough to avenge this indignity? How can I make myself big enough to face into these guys and say no further? Well, he worked it out with Xi, and the real surprise, what I have to say again, is that the Chinese have come full square in support of what Putin has done to the extent of his invasion of Ukraine. That is very big because it's a break in Chinese policy, and it's a break in Chinese lack of interest in getting involved in problems as far afield as Western Europe.
Scott, your thoughts?
That was Ray McGovern, Scott Ritter, the UN inspector, inspecting dismantling of weaponry in Russia some time ago when